sea ice is one way that scientists can learn about the effects of climate change. Larry Mueller here. The weather guys are back to talk about this year's sea ice report. John Martin, one of our weather guys, in the studio with me. John's professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And Steve Ackerman back as well, former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison. He's an emeritus professor as well in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And Steve, good to see your smiling face.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Larry.
So we'll talk about what we need to know about sea ice. We'll look at water spouts. We can celebrate the 75th anniversary of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well. Questions about sea ice, other questions, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. For the most part, it feels like we had a pretty warm fall, at least in southern Wisconsin. What caused the higher temperatures, just to begin with?
That's a good question. We were about, I think, 3 degrees
three
above normal for much of October.
Yeah.
And it was partitioned, as it often is now, between about a 2 degree above average daytime high and about a 4.5 degree above average overnight low. In fact, on what was it? It was on Thursday night into Friday. We had our warmest late October overnight temperature since 1946,
Wow.
Which was 64 degrees.
Yeah.
So pretty amazing. Warm because we just had a circulation anomaly that kept us with the winds coming throughout the whole column of the atmosphere, largely from the west or the southwest occasionally, as opposed to the northwest, which becomes more common as we move into the cold season. And that makes all the difference.
Yeah.
So that was really a big part of it.
Yeah. Well, what about sea ice? First, where do you find sea ice?
So there's two primary areas when we think about sea ice. Is that's that surrounded the Arctic Ocean and the North Pole, and then also sea ice around the South Pole, around Antarctica. And we're coming in November, in September, early October is when we typically have our minimum amount of sea ice, aerial coverage in the North Pole over the Arctic, and maximum sea ice in Antarctic because it's their wintertime, so we're out of season. And it was kind of an interesting year this year because in Arctic, we had our sixth fewest aerial coverage of sea ice ever observed since 1979. And in the Antarctic, where we're supposed to have the maximum, it was the smallest maximum amount of sea ice that we've ever observed since 79.
How thick does it get?
So in some of the areas, it could be really thick. It's kind of an interesting different types of sea ice in terms of how it forms. Both are associated with the ocean temperatures. But if you take away sea ice in the North Pole, you basically find water. I mean, that's where the Arctic Sea, Arctic Ocean is. And if you do that over the South Pole, you don't have water. You have land. And so... part of the thing that happens with the Antarctic is that in addition to the temperature of the water playing a role, as well as the daytime or night, the seasonal cold that occurs during winter, the glaciers also play a role because as they come down off of the Antarctic Peninsula, they push the ice on to the ocean, and then it gets counted out as sea ice. And that ice can be pretty thick because it's been up in the Antarctic for, you know, decades.
Yeah. So like a half mile thick or a quarter mile thick?
I think quarter mile thick, and then it gets thinner. It depends if it's new ice or old ice. I don't know in the Arctic what the old ice thickness typically
Neither
is.
Neither do I. I know though that that's one of the categories that they use to categorize what the ice is like, both during the wintertime and at the melt season. The more that melts, you know, in the melt season, which ends around the equinox, is... It sets you up for the next year having 1 year old ice, which is not very thick, and the percentage of ice cover that's more than 3 years old in the Arctic, the northern latitudes, has gone down to something like 60% of what it was just 1979, and that means that it's habitually freezing and freezing and melting every year, and we're not making any ground up, so it's bad news.
And we're seeing a decrease of like 4% per decade mm-hmm. of the aerial extent of the sea ice in the Northern Hemisphere around the Arctic.
Yeah.
So the question is, why is it the biggest? I mean, what factors? I'm climate change, but what?
So it's both the climate change is associated with the warming of the atmosphere, but also the oceans are warming up as well. And so you have warmer oceans, you're transporting warmer water further northward, then that's going to melt the sea ice from below where it's in contact with the ocean surface.
And you're melting it on the periphery. That's always how it goes. When things get warmer, they get warmer on the edge, the cold edge first. And it's the same with the 850 millibar cold pool that I keep track of as a measure of the climate change. It's clear as day that you only push the coldest air back a little bit at each of the longitudes, and you're doing the same with the ice. And it's really bad news. And there's interannual variability on top of the big climate signal. And 2012 had the lowest sea ice extent at the end of the melt season ever. And we're 11 years past that now. And we're only, the fifth, I think, or sixth?
Yeah, sixth.
Smallest. There's interannual variability on top of that climate signal. But the climate signal's constantly pushing it back. And once in a while, maybe a year can have a little bit of extra ice, and other years don't.
Mm. As you were talking, I was thinking about my days of ice fishing on Lake Mendota, where I would, as it was getting warmer, I would take a plank and put it down and walk on the plank from the shore to get over the thinnest ice that's right next to the shore to the thicker ice that was further out. Yeah. So that's I guess that's what you're talking about there.
Yeah, you're always kidding. And in that case, the land is warming up a little bit and maybe eroding the ice on the edge as opposed to way out at the middle of the lake on the first warm day of mid-late February.
Bob in Kewaunee has a question for you. Bob, hi.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. It's in regards to our present weather. Is this a polar vortex? And if it is, are we going to expect more of these, or can we hope this is it?
You don't like winter. Is that what I get?
We're on opposite ends of the spectrum. This is my favorite day of the year. First day where I get below freezing at my house. No, it's not. It's not one of these polar vortex events. That's a really, a gigantic piece of a broader feature that's been known for decades as the polar vortex. It develops as the hemisphere cools down, as we move past the equinox into the wintertime. It's become popularly described as this invasion of really cold air that lasts a few days and can be really bitterly cold. This is just a normal transition between a weather system that passed us over the late part of last week, and then in its wake, the first really decent cold snap of the year is the cold air that funnels in southward, along the Canadian and then United States Rockies. So we're in the middle of that right now, and there'll be more to come.
Yeah. There'll be more.
End of fall. We're going into
And I'm not sorry to say it. We were talking out in the lobby, Steve was saying, I forgot to do.
I forgot to turn my heat on.
Forgot to turn his heat on. Clara forgot to dig out her winter jacket. And I said to both of them, look, we know this is coming. Come on. It happens every year.
Well, back to the sea ice for a minute. What's the projection on... Do we have a projection on what's happening? What's going to happen 50 years from now, or whatever?
So I think in the Arctic we have a good sense of what's going on. The global warming, the warming of the oceans is going to cause the amount of sea ice to decrease, and we've been seeing that statistically. As I said, 4% per decade, the amount of aerial coverage is going down. Now, if you look at the Antarctic, that's not quite the same. There really is no statistical trend in the amount of sea ice around Antarctica, and I think that's because of Antarctica. And part of the role of that sea ice in formation is both the temperatures at the Arctic Ocean and the area around it, but also the glaciers. So as that area warms up, the glaciers slide more, and that pushes that ice out onto the ocean. So I think there's a real question about what's going to happen in the South Pole, maybe not 50 years from now, but 150 years as we continue to warm up. Those glaciers begin to move more. What's going to happen to the ice around Antarctica, but also what the heck's going to happen to the landmass of Antarctica?
Yeah, right.
Because that's a lot of weight
yeah.
currently pushing down the landmass. And
yeah.
you take that ice away, and you're going to have some rebounding of the land.
Yeah, they say that's true about Iceland. Something as small as Iceland that loses ice has a rebound in the Earth's crust. And Greenland would be the next big place that could really feel that. And certainly the Antarctic continent would have something to say about that as well. Yeah, and, you know, it's not just a cosmetic thing that you lose sea ice at high latitudes. It's really got a lot of feedbacks. Because if you don't have ice over the polar oceans in the northern hemisphere, which, as Steve pointed out earlier, there's no land underneath them, then snowflakes in the late winter will just be falling right into the ocean. And then when finally the sun comes up at the North Pole, there's no sheet of ice with snow on it that would reflect all of that incoming solar radiation. So it gets absorbed by the now exposed ocean. Then it furthers the warming at those locations. In fact, they're already warming faster than anywhere else in the northern hemisphere. The Arctic regions are, despite the fact they have a 6-month winter. So, you know, it's going to get worse, and that's not good.
It's kind of scary, but a good topic before Halloween.
Yeah, right.
That's for sure. Yeah. And we're seeing, you know, efforts to sea walls and everything else. It's going to be just huge impacts.
Yeah, when you release all of that frozen water into liquid state, it's going to raise sea levels and all sorts of other things. And as you point out, they have to take precautions.
Well, on that happy pre-Halloween note, we're going to take a look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then you'll have a chance to join in with your own weather questions. Maybe it's about sea ice. Maybe it's about just some weather thing that's happened in your area. You and Cannon Littleshoot sent us a really good picture. We're going to talk about that after our news break as well. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, and you can follow Ken's suit and go ahead and post a photo if you have one weather related, and we'll comment on that as well. I'm Larry Mueller with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with the weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Great to have them back with us today as we talk weather and climate. Join in. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Ken in Littleshoot emailed us a photo, a really nice photo, of a cloud formation across the whole sky on Saturday morning in the Littleshoot area. Is this what he wonders? Is this a wall cloud? How's it formed, and what does it tell us about upcoming weather?
Yeah, it seemed to us it looked more like a cirrus cloud deck that had a very sharp edge, and that edge would have been produced by gentle, probably very gentle, almost hard to determine subsidence, which would force the air to sink on that edge. And when it sinks, the water droplets will evaporate away because the air that sinks gets warmed up by compression. And sometimes you get these beautiful, sharp edges to these kind of stratocumulus decks. And it looks like that's what that particular event was. And I mistook it for what I saw on Thursday morning. I should have said Thursday morning. It did look more like a wall cloud Thursday morning in Middleton when I was out playing tennis. That was interesting,
but
in a different way.
A wall cloud to me is, you know, around a severe weather.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's dark.
That's very much more menacing. Yeah, these are just beautiful, though. You can sometimes see them cover the whole half of the sky, as I think Ken's picture shows. And, this one that I saw on Thursday morning that was maybe more roll cloud-like was not attached directly to a menacing storm anyway. But it had rained overnight, so maybe it was connected to something that was on its deathbed or something.
Kristen in Ripon has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kristen.
Good morning, guys. I just love this conversation. And I had some kind of, it just got my mind rolling. And I was thinking about, I know with the coral reefs and things like that, they're being affected by the temperature in a very bad way. Now, I was wondering if with the melting of the ice caps, like you were talking, is that going to have any effect on the salinity in the oceans? And if so, would that affect any of the flora or fauna in the oceans? And then my follow-up question to that is, I heard recently there was a point made that the salt line in the aquifers underneath, is like especially around Florida and things, is moving inland 330 feet a year due to the amount of water that's being pumped for crops and things like that. And so it's drawing the salt into the aquifers under the ground. And with the multitude of our population being on coastlines, you know, where are they going to seek out water? Or do you think it's going to be something where they're going to start desalinating water in order to use it from their wells? And how do we expect that they're not going to just want to grab onto and change the compact on the Great Lakes and take all our fresh water and start piping it everywhere?
A lot of good questions there.
Yeah. The melting of the sea ice is a good question because they're all good questions. Yeah. The sea ice and the ice on land is fresh water. And so as that melts and it goes into the ocean, it's less dense than the salt water. And so it floats on top of the salt water. And so that could change surface currents because of that. I think overall, if you were to mix that all in with the ocean is so big that it's going to change the salinity, but probably not in a measurable method.
Yeah, and that's where storms come in. You know, storms in the atmosphere on top will come in and do a lot of that mixing and by creating big waves and moving that water around. But in the absence of that, storms kind of die off. At the same time you get melting, you can have really big problems with the circulation of the ocean locally, and that's a bad deal. This salinity creep in places like Florida, that's really interesting. I didn't know about that, but it makes perfect sense. And it is dangerous. Maybe some people down there who are currently not so in favor of a federal government would suddenly be in favor of a federal government that comes in and says, we'll desalinize your water so that you can drink it. And it'd be interesting to see how that changes some of the regional politics of parts of our country, these kinds of threats. But you're exactly right to be on top of thinking about all of the consequences of some of these physical processes. They don't just happen in a vacuum. They happen, in interaction with societies. And these are really important questions.
And I think we also see that happening in the Louisiana region as well. We have a daughter who lives down there. And they're seeing the same thing now. She's not on well water. But nonetheless, you're seeing it, and it's affecting the region. And, you know, this is why Larry probably knows more than us about the Great Lakes PACs with regard to water and what we're doing with Canada, because there's not only just the worry about losing the Great Lakes water during this type of condition of the salinification of wells and things, but also just droughts. That was a big concern with regard to droughts in the Midwest a decade or so ago.
Right, and warm winters. Ice is the Great Lakes' best friend. You want ice on the lakes as much as you can get it, because the year in 2014-15 when we had it, that was when we started to get a little bit of an increase in the volume of water in the lakes, finally, after more than a decade. So ice is good. Cold is good for the Great Lakes.
The pact is pretty tight.
It is pretty tight between U.S. and Canada.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I thought. So I don't think, I don't know what would
you can't predict politics.
There'd have to be some kind of revolution that would have to go on in order for that to happen.
It'd be hard to overturn something like that.
It's going to be, very, very hard. Kind of to go sort of along with this, Jack from Milwaukee wonders is there any modeling that tells us if or when the sea ice melt will affect the Gulf Stream?
There's both theories about past events and also forecasts about future ones that would shut down the so-called thermohaline circulation along the west coast of the western boundary of the Atlantic Basin, which is where the Gulf Stream is. And one of the processes that people have their finger on is melting of sea ice, melting of ice off of Greenland. And that, just as Steve said a minute ago, produces fresh water on the top of the North Atlantic Ocean, and that slows down the circulation that drives a giant conveyor belt. And the circulation in the North Atlantic tends to be driven by cold air outbreaks, which chill the water on top, evaporate water off the top, and make it more saline, and then it sinks for both reasons. It's colder and more dense because it's got more salt in it, and that's part of the circulation gyre that brings warm water from the tropics up along the western boundary current. And if you can shut that down, that subsidence of water, if you can shut that down, you've got a really big problem. And there's theories that say it could happen in half a lifetime. under the right conditions. So it could be a sudden shutdown of the Gulf Stream. I don't know.
And if what that's would be the result? The
You'd, all of a sudden, places like London that are have been spending centuries at 53 or 4 degrees north latitude would suddenly feel like they're at 53 or north latitude.
A little colder and
winter. Be a lot colder. I mean, it'd be back to Dickens-type winters or something, or worse than that. And then it'd be all manner of other types of ecosystem problems as well, because, you know, the whole ocean basin adjusts to that circulation. And if it shuts down, lots of things would change.
Mm. Walt in Fort Atkinson has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Walt.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. What I'm interested in is using aerosols in the upper atmosphere to block sunlight partially. And I heard a plan which was kind of different, and I hadn't heard about it again. And that was to only apply those aerosols over the polar regions during that pole's summer. So in the northern atmosphere or hemisphere, our summer, and in our winter, over the Antarctic. And that way it would not affect temperate and tropical regions and would help to preserve polar ice. Have you heard of that? What do you think of that?
I hadn't heard about it going over just the poles. The first thing that runs into my in my mind, you're right. If you put those small particles up there, those aerosols, it's going to reflect the solar energy out and keep things colder. Of course, there's also chemistry involved. Mm-hmm. And so once you put those particles, whatever they're made out of, up into the stratosphere, which is very stable, they're going to be there and able to act, depending on, again, what they're made of, I guess, with the chemistry that's up there, which means the ozone layer. And that used to be a concern for many years because of aerosols.
Yeah, and I've also not heard of this particular variant by doing a seasonally varying, experiment with aerosols in certain parts of the globe. But the other thing that always strikes me about these proposals is that they state it as if we have a perfect understanding of how the dispersion of these particles is going to take place after they've been let out into the atmosphere. Every year, the circulation's different enough that you could have all kinds of variability in the way those things get dispersed, and they may disperse in a way that doesn't actually further your goal. And then what do you do then? So they're the scariest possible set of proposals because there's too many unknowns, and you have so little control over what happens with the experimental devices, the aerosols themselves.
That's true. There is weather up there.
Yeah, there sure is. There sure is.
Raleigh in Oak Creek. On to you now. Hi, Raleigh.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Again, this is a physics question again, kind of like the last caller. A while back, I watched a YouTube video which claimed that it is actually the water vapor in the air that's actually doing the warming, more or less, or holding on to the heat. It's kind of confused me that the CO2 is actually something that's enabling the water to, be vaporous and hold on to the water. I wonder if you can clarify that or correct that.
Yeah.
Logic.
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is that if you put the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and you warm the temperature, what happens when the temperature warms up on average is you get more water vapor in the atmosphere. And so the humidity generally goes up. That's why you never find it, I'm going to say something that was wrong, so I'm going to stop saying that. But so that's how it gets kind of what we would call a feedback loop. You start warming up the temperature, you're going to put more water vapor into the atmosphere, and that acts like a greenhouse gas as well, transparent to solar radiation and absorbs the infrared emitted by the Earth's surface.
Yeah, and another subtle point about this is that a lot of the climate skeptics, and some of them have websites, climate change skeptics, no one's skeptical that there's a climate. I shouldn't have said it that way. Right. Climate change, there is a climate, but there's climate change skeptics. And they will say, correctly, that water vapor is the most potent of the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. That's absolutely right. And the problem is with water vapor in their argument, they don't say this, is that it rains itself out every 9 days. And so it's gone as soon as it's put into the atmosphere. So it doesn't have any residence time at all. Carbon dioxide lasts 60 to 100 years. So you can slowly increase the concentration of something like carbon dioxide, perhaps without noticing it because it doesn't precipitate. And by the time you go 100 years past 1850 or past 1900, like where we are now, you have, you know, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than the Earth's had in the last 100 or a million or so years, million and a half years. And so that's really governing the change. It's not the water vapor, even though the water vapor is a potent greenhouse gas. It gets put in and it gets rained out. So it's not really doing any long-term damage.
Interesting. Okay. Dean in Colorado, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Good morning. We're in Colorado, and we woke up to 5 degrees and a foot of snow.
Man.
And that got me thinking about a hypothesis I heard some time ago where the polar vortex or polar high is often confined to the Arctic, more or less, because of the consistent tundra versus boreal forest boundary, which now has been encroached, that tundra area, by more and more of the boreal forest. And that potentially that could lead to more instability in that consistency. And you get these meanderings of the jet stream like we just weathered through here yesterday and the day before. And I wanted to also follow up. Tampa does get a bit of water, from desalination. And imagine that's going to continue moving forward as that area grows down that way.
Yeah,
the polar vortex question is always a good one, and it's an important opportunity to make the statement that the true polar vortex occurs in the lower and upper stratosphere, or lower and middle stratosphere, and it's just beginning now to rev up by the time you get to about mid-October. That's when the winds really start to encircle the North Pole at very high latitude, and they do start to close in or expand, but what they do is they put a fence around the really cold air, but at very high elevations in the atmosphere. Now, you're referencing correctly the land differences, you know, between high Arctic and sort of the middle Arctic, where you go from the tundra to the boreal forest. And that is an important radiative difference there. But it's not going to matter much in about a month because the sun's going to be down at all those places. So you're going to be able to cook up pretty cold air everywhere over that expansive region. And then the only thing that delivers the cold air to latitudes like ours are, in fact, these meanders of the jet stream. And they are commonly part of the circulation of the atmosphere. One question, though, scientists are asking themselves now is, are those meanders getting more common and more high amplitude? And do they have a seasonality in those changes? And we're not sure we have the answer to that yet, but I'm kind of involved in that game a little bit myself. And it seems to me that I can say with confidence that in the wintertime, December, January, and February, the jet streams have become wavier in the last 65 to 70 years. Why that's the case, I can't say. I don't know yet. And what ramifications it has beyond the obvious of maybe a little more frequent excursions of some of that cold air southward, I don't know either. So we're still working on that problem. It's a good problem.
Yeah, there you go.
So when you say wavier over the last 65, 75 years, does that mean there's a trend towards the waviness?
Yes, there's a trend in the waviness, and it's at the 96% significance level. Wow. It's really high. Okay. Yeah.
And speaking of trends, I know you guys were writing about in your latest column, I think, about hurricanes. And are they intensifying more quickly? Is there a trend that we're getting more intense? And we certainly saw that in Mexico.
Yeah, so we are seeing an increase in the quick intensification, and often that's occurring as the storm approaches land, which would be somewhat anticipated in the sense that the water's shallower there, so it may warm up faster. So they're looking at that, and that was a real big issue in the storm that just hit Mexico.
Yeah, that Otis, 12 Otis. Hours it went from a tropical storm to a Category 5 intensity.
I mean, that's just incredible.
165 mile an hour wind, something like that?
Yeah, and a dead hit on Acapulco. Yeah. It could have hit any place else on the coast, but it hit the major city. So.
And that type of, you know, rapid intensification, particularly occurring near the shoreline, becomes a real problem for warning people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, because a lot of times, you know, where you're getting a couple of day warning that a tornado, not a tornado, that a hurricane's going to hit you,
yeah.
and people can react to that and plan for it. But boy, when you're getting less than 12 hours.
12 hours is the time I wake up to the time I come home from work.
Right, yeah, you know? Right.
That's incredible on any given day.
Yeah, right. You're not thinking about how to get in the car and get out of there.
Right.
Mark in Sussex has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you guys would know, we had a little cooling period from about 1945 to about 1975, and I've read that was due to the sulfides in gasoline. Is that an accurate statement?
I thought some of that cooling, and I didn't know it went all the way to 1975. I thought it went to about 1965 or maybe 1960.
Yeah,
just a little shorter, at least the reference I've heard about it. And I thought it was increased volcanic activity around the globe.
Right.
There was a period of kind of unusually active volcanism, and that puts various chemicals and aerosols in the atmosphere that do act as a shade on the sun. And so that was one of the primary mechanisms that might have led to that little bit of cooling that was experienced in that period of time. Although I don't know if that's the only one.
I think so. That's what's clicking my mind, too, because the what ends up happening with those explosive volcanoes is you end up getting with sulfuric acid droplets up in the stratosphere, which is very stable.
Mm.
We could observe those on satellites. I actually remember doing a study on that. So I think maybe that's what was happening. During that time period. Yeah. And that, of course, reflects solar energy, so you don't get the warm
temperatures. Yeah, Mark, thank you. Heidi emailed us. She was on a family vacation in Ontario, Canada in the 90s, and on a clear day, they witnessed a large area of water. Looked like a tornado, at least as big as a house, but it was not spinning. The water was coming out of the lake and falling back into the lake. It was not spinning, and it was not windy out. It looked like these slow motion pictures of drops of water landing on other water. It lasted at least a minute or two. It took the sound of splashing water. The water went up and over the outside. It was a cylinder shape. Do you guys have any idea?
How far away from the observer?
Don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. I mean, if it was far away, you wouldn't be able to detect the rotation of kind of a wimpy little water spout. So that might account, and I don't know that that's right, but that might account for why there was no obvious rotation. But then that makes it difficult to understand why you'd hear the water drops, unless you were hearing them at fairly remotely from where the water spout was. They were landing closer to you, kind of ejected in the vortex and then making their way towards you 1,000 yards or so, and you could hear them dropping. I don't know.
Oh,
that's the only thing I can think of. That's the first thing I should say.
It's always amazes me when people come observe these things and describe it, and you think, wow, what?
I'm immediately jealous. I wish I could see something like that.
Well, you guys weren't around for the start of it, but the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences turning 75.
Mm. Yeah, it's we've had a fabulous history in this program, and it's funny. I think since we've been on the radio for a number of years, people finally said, I didn't know you had a program in meteorology and climate and ocean science in the University of Wisconsin. It's nobody's fault, I guess, except our own, that people don't know that. But 75 years of incredible advances in understanding and monitoring of the Earth and the atmosphere and the oceans by satellite, by theory, predicting the weather and making forecast models and various things. It's a glorious history. I'm really proud to have spent my career in this department, and to have been affiliated with it in any way at all is a badge of honor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on that note, the weather is going to be different the next time you're on. I can almost guarantee it.
I will guarantee it that John will like it a lot more than I will.
Yeah, that's probably right. That's a safe bet.
I'm
expecting a little snow by then.
Steve Ackerman, former chair, vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John is a professor in that department, former chair of it as well. Great to have them with us. They will be back the last Monday in November. Well, tomorrow on the show, just in time for Halloween, we'll look at some murder mysteries. There's a book out on the best dishes to go alongside Agatha Christie's murder mysteries, and we'll get some tips on new mystery series to read. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.